And we're holding on Lamed Vav Amud Beis, five lines from the bottom. We learned in the Mishnah case, again, we're talking throughout Perek about a Mudur Hana, where a person is bound by a neder to not have Hana from the other person. So we've been calling them all this time. Reuven is also to have Hana from Shimon. And again, for all purposes, it doesn't really matter whether it's that Reuven initiated the neder, that he's not going to have Hana from Shimon, or whether it's the other way around, that Shimon initiated the neder, that you, Reuven, are also to have Hana from me. Either way, the dinim are going to be the same thing. Anyway, the Mishnah had said, Melamde medresh halachas va'agadais. So now the one from whom he's also to have Hana, Shimon, is allowed to teach Reuven medresh, or halachas, or agadais, which we said on the Mishnah, the Rosh had defined them. Medrash means medrashe halacha, for example, sifra or sifri. Halachas would be halachas l'moshe misinai. Agada would be anything that we think of as agada. Ava lo yilamdenu mikra, but the Mishnah had said that Shimon would not be allowed to teach Reuven mikra tanach. So let's figure out why. The Gemara asked, mikra my time lo yilamdenu. On the face of it, what would be the reason that he can't teach him Mikra, that he can't teach him Tanakh? On the face of it, Mishum become a Hanilei, because he's giving him a Hana by teaching him for free. Now, we're not even talking about necessarily the Hana of learning Torah. In and out, we've discussed before the concept mitzvah slav lahonis nitnu, the benefit, the Hana that you get, the enjoyment that you get from doing a mitzvah, from learning, is not necessarily considered a hana in halacha, but still, fine, you're going to say, because otherwise Reuven would have to pay Shimon, and now like this he's not, so therefore he benefits. Well, medrash nami kama hanilei. Wouldn't the same thing be true of medrash as well, and the other things mentioned in the Mishnah? So why is the Mishnah making that distinction? The answer is amashmul, but makam shenotlin schar ala mikra. Because we're talking about the Mishnah, in fact, is talking about a place where people do get paid for teaching mikra, for teaching Tanakh. The in notlin schar ala medrash, but this is the kind of place where you don't get a schar for teaching medrash. Well, the Gemara says, my poska. So then in that case, if it depends on different minhagim in different places, then why is the Mishnah saying as a definitive statement, as a blanket statement, that he can teach him mikra, but not medrash? The Mishnah should be saying that, first of all, it could be the other way around. And second of all, the Mishnah should say that whatever he's going to be teaching him, tipol schar lahekdesh, the schar should be given to hekdesh, like we had at the beginning of the perek, as far as Hashava Saveda. Why is the Mishnah assuming as an obvious thing that there is schar involved for mikra, but not for medrash? And the answer is, hokamash malon. The answer is, the Mishnah is informing us that even in places where people get paid for teaching mikra, so even in places where people get paid ala mikra shori la mishkal, if they're getting paid, if it's for teaching mikra, they're allowed to take payment for that. Ala medrash loy shori la mishkal, but for medrash and the other things of Torah Shabbat Peh that we mentioned, you're not allowed to take payment. Meaning, in other words, the Ran teaches out like this. The Mishnah is telling us like this. As far as the strict din is concerned, you're allowed to get paid for teaching mikra. You're not allowed to get paid for teaching medrash for reasons that the Gemara is going to explain in the next couple of lines. There are places where they have the minhag that people are machna on themselves. They won't even take payment for mikra. So in such places, yes, you're allowed to teach a mikra. The Mishnah is Well, first of all, keep in mind, we're talking about when Torah Shabbat Peh wasn't written down yet. Mikra was written down, of course. Medrash and Halachas and so forth were not yet written down. They were all still Torah Shabbat Peh. So it's not separate Sfarim. There would be Sfarim for Mikra and everything else would be taught verbally. So the reason for the distinction, why one you're allowed to take payment and the other not, we'll get to in the next couple of lines of the Gemara. But
what is called Midrash?
Midrash, so we explained the other day, the Rosh explained that Midrash means things like Sifra and Sifri, the Midrashim that that take the Psukim and analyze them and derive halachas from them. So there were collections, there were known collections of such things, but they weren't written down yet. They were all by heart.
Or that they wasn't paid for.
So we're talking about, in other words, if Shimon is teaching Reuven, just if Shimon is teaching Reuven Medrash, then he's not allowed to get paid for it. So therefore, so then there's no Hana involved. So that's the thing. So the Ran says, so in places where they're machmer on themselves and they don't get paid for anything, then sure, he could teach him anything because then there's no payment involved. The Mishnah is talking about a place where there is where people do get paid for Mikra because they are entitled to Api Alofa, but still you would think he's not allowed to teach a Mikra because then if he teaches a Mikra and foregoes his salary, then he's giving him Hana. Given that Medrash, anyway, you're not allowed to take payment for, then in that case, there's no Hana. Because again, mitzvah slav l'honis nitnu, the fact that he's teaching Reuven and Reuven is learning something new and enjoying it, that enjoyment is not considered an enjoyment in halacha because mitzvah slav l'honis nitnu. So the Gemara says, so Maishna Medrash Deloy, well, let's figure that out. Why is there that difference? Why with Medrash would you not be allowed to take payment? The reason must be dichtiv, because the Pasuk says, Moshe says to the Jewish people, Hashem commanded me at that time to teach you the Torah. And you have another pasuk a little earlier. See that I have taught you chukam and mishpatim as Hashem commanded me. Now, what is that? Now, what are those words? Kashet zivani me. So the Ran explains, obviously it can't mean that he's saying that Hashem commanded me to teach you with pay, because obviously if a teacher wants to teach them for free, he's certainly allowed to. It's not like Moshe is telling them there's a mitzvah to take payment. It also can't mean that Moshe is stressing to them, you should be aware that everything I'm teaching you is what Hashem taught me, and I haven't made up mitzvahs of my own, because the Ran says, we know that everybody believed in that. He says the Jewish people had no question about that. In fact, before Mount Torah, Hashem had told Moshe, "Gam b'chol yaminu l'olam," they will believe in you forever. The Ran doesn't add, but I mean, we can add for ourselves. Okay, you know, you had the one group that claimed that it wasn't so, Korach, and we know what happened, Korach and his group, and we know what happened to them. So now at the end of the 40 years in Parashas Vaschanan, which is where these psukim are from, when Moshe is reviewing the Torah for the Jewish people and telling them Kasher Tzivani Hashem, he doesn't have to be stressing to them that he's doing exactly what Hashem said and not adding his own things, because at that point, everybody already believes that. It can't mean that he's saying that Hashem commanded me to teach you with pay, because there'd be no reason for that. Obviously, if you could do it for pay, you could equally well do it without pay. So therefore, instead, we daushin from those psukim, ma ani b'chinam afatam nami b'chinam. Means just like I was for free, just like I am for free, so you are for free. Which there's two ways of explaining what that means. It can mean I learned from Hashem for free. Hashem didn't charge me to teach me the Torah. And the same way I am teaching you for free. Or it can mean that I learned from Hashem, that Hashem taught me for free, or it can mean I'm teaching you for free, and you in the future, throughout the generations, when you're teaching Torah, you also teach for free. Either way, however we learn it, the point is that we learn from that, that Torah is supposed to be taught for free. Well then, the question is, why should there be a difference in that regard between Mikra on the one hand, where we're saying that the Mishnah is implying that you're allowed to take payment for it, and therefore, in the case of a mudr hana, you can't teach it to him because then you're foregoing. Then either you're going to get paid or you're foregoing your payment. Versus medrash and so forth, where you're not allowed to get paid. What's the difference? They're all part of Torah. The answer is so that's the question. Mikra nami b'chinam. So shouldn't mikra also be so? Given that drasha, so then teaching mikra should also be done for free. So why is the Mishnah making that distinction? So the answer is Rav Omaschar Shimur. The answer is the reason why you should be allowed to take, it's true, there shouldn't be a distinction. However, there is a reason why with Mikra, you have more of a heter to take payment. Rav Omaschar Shimur. Rav says, because there's the fact you're taking payment for watching the children. Nikra, unlike the other things, Medrash and so forth, are taught to older children, to older children or to adults. Tosfos mentions, after all, we have in the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, where it says that even Mishnah, they only start learning at 10 years old. And apparently the 10-year-olds of those times were a lot more mature than the 10-year-olds of nowadays. You don't really need to watch them so much. But little kids, Ben Chomish Lemikra, you have to watch them, says the Rosh, that they don't run out into the street and cause damage, for example. So therefore, when you're being paid for teaching Mikra, you're not really being paid for teaching the Mikra itself. That would be included in what Moshe is saying, Ma'ani b'chinam afetam b'chinam. You're being paid basically to be a babysitter, to make sure that the kids don't run out. So therefore, that would apply only to Mikra, which is done at a younger age. So then we're going to see in the Gemara soon, in that case, then why is our Mishnah making that distinction if on the face of it, our Mishnah is talking about adults? So we're going to get back to that in a few lines. So that's one reason. But Rabbi Yochanan almost schar pisuk time. Rabbi Yochanan says a different reason, because when you're teaching Tanakh, you're not only teaching the words and the meanings of the words, you're also teaching them the trup. You're also teaching them the trup and how the trup functioned to divide up the sentences and whatever. All of that is part of Torah Shebaal Peh. At that time, the trup weren't written down. They were only written down hundreds of years later. So therefore, that's included. So both the Ran and the Rosh use the expression that those are not Daraisa. Now, what does that mean? Does that mean that according to Rabbi Yochanan, the Trup are not actually the Moshe Mitzrayim? So we're going to see later in the Gemara that it may mean that. It may mean that they actually hold that the Trup were devised only later. And there are, in fact, some of the Mefoshim who learn that way, who learn that such things, such as the Trup, and maybe even to a certain extent in the Kodesh, were added later by the Anshe Knesset Gadola, by Ezra or whoever. On the other hand, we're going to learn later in the Gemara that a different opinion, which is going to be the opinion of Rab, that no, those are part of the Torah as given to Moshe at Har Sinai. Includes the Nekudas and the Terup, the actual Nekudas and Terup were, again, they were part of Torah Shebaal Peh. They were only written down in the beginning in the time of the Goinim, which is long after the time of the Gemara even, but they existed all the way. So Rabbi Yochanan is telling us they're not Daraisa. That could mean, he could mean by that they're literally not Daraisa and were added only later by the Chachamim, or he could mean that they are in fact Daraisa, but they're part of Torah Shebaal Peh, just like Medrash and so forth. And therefore, the Chassam Sofer explains that Rabbi Yochanan could mean not that they didn't exist Daraisa, but that there's no requirement Daraisa to teach them. When you're teaching Mikra, it's not necessary specifically that you teach it to them with the Torah. You see, for example, nowadays, when they teach kids Chumash, they don't necessarily teach it to them with Torah. Some places do, in fact. So Rabbi Yochanan could be saying that's not included in the basic mitzvah of teaching, of Talmud Torah, of teaching kids Chumash and teaching kids Tanakh. So therefore you have more of a heter to take pay for that. Whereas on the other hand, Medrash and Halachas and so forth don't have Turup associated with them. So therefore, there's nothing to talk about that. Okay. So the Gemara says, Tanah. Now let's look at our Mishnah and see whether it fits better with Rabbi Yochanan's or Rav's explanation. We said, Lo yilamdenu Mikra. We said in the case of a Mudra Hanah, he's not allowed to teach a Mikra. So, Bishleima Lamanda almost schar pisuk taimim, according to Rabbi Yochanan, who says that when you're teaching Mikra, then you're allowed to get paid for pisuk taimim, for teaching them the Turup, because again, either what we would say is that the Turup are not actually Lamosha Misinai, or we would say they are, but they're not an essential part of learning Tanakh. Well, that explains then why it is that now in the case of a Mudra Hanah, he can't teach it. Because you're teaching an adult Tanakh, you're going to be teaching it to him with the Torah. We're saying that according to that way of looking at it, you're allowed to take payment for teaching him the Tanim, for teaching him the Torah. And since you're a Mudra Hanah, then you can't do that. So that explains the Mishnah very neatly. But according to Rav, who says that you're only entitled to be, according to him, the Trup are an essential part of Tanakh. and they're also the Moshe Mitzrayim. And when you're teaching them, it's the same as any other part of Torah. And the only reason that a teacher is allowed to take a salary is Schar Shimur, because he's watching the kids and preventing them from running out. Well, Godol Bar Shimur, who is an adult, somebody who has to be watched. Our Mishnah, but Pashtus is talking about adults. So then in that case, what would be the problem? So Mikra, in that, according to Rav, would be the same as any other part of Torah. You can't take payment for teaching it. So according to Rav, why would the Mishnah be making the distinction? The answer is the Gemara says, okay, B'katan, you know what? Our Mishnah is not talking about an adult. Our Mishnah is talking about a child. Now, if it's a child, then what's the problem? The Ran says the fact is, if a child is doing something that's osur, you don't have to stop him because he's not yet a bar das, he's not yet chayiv in mitzvahs. So the Ran says true, but now his father has a mitzvah of chinuch on him, so his father has to prevent him from doing something that's osur. But we're not talking about that over here. We're talking about a third party. We learned back in Yevamos that if a katan is eating nevela, for example, the local beistin is not obligated to stop him. His father has a mitzvah too, but other than that, the local beistin does not have a responsibility, al pi Torah, to stop him. However, the Ran says that's true. But the Gemara also said over there, you're not allowed to actually give him, biyadayim, something that's osur. Well then, suppose that there exists a neder that puts that prevents the katan from being able to have hanah from you. So in the scenario that we've been using so far, Reuven is a katan. Now in that case, how did he make neder? So one possibility is he didn't. So we're talking about, let's say that Shimon, to begin with, made the neder that Reuven, the katan, won't have hanah from him. Whatever the case, we'll get back to that in a second. The point is, you're not allowed to go and give something, you're not allowed to go and give a cotton, something blatantly, something which is also to him. Well, in that case, since this Hana is also to Reuven, then therefore, we would be saying that that's what the Mishnah is talking about, given that there is Schar Shimur involved, that you, Shimon, teaching Reuven the cotton, would be entitled, according to Rav, to get paid for Schar Shimur, for babysitting him, for making sure that Reuven doesn't run out into the street and cause damage. Then therefore, if you're foregoing that, then you're giving Reuven a Hana, and you can't do that. So that's one possibility. We could be talking about that Reuven himself never made the neder in the first place. There is also the point the Rashba explains. Now, we haven't really gotten into this very much. The Gemara gets into this in other places in Shas, that there's a concept called muflas somoch la'ish, that a child within a year before their bar or bas mitzvah, they are capable of making the nedarim, and their neder is going to be chal if they know at that point in their life that a neder is addressed, that a neder is a promise to Hashem. So a boy beginning from 12, a girl beginning from 11, if they make a neder, we ask them, do you know what a neder is? And if they say, yes, we know that a neder is a promise to Hashem, then their neder is chal. So we could be talking about a case like that. We could be talking about that Reuven is an 11-year-old boy, I'm sorry, a 12-year-old boy, and therefore his nedarim are chal. It's another way of understanding it over here. So the Gemara says, Ibakotten. Okay, so if you're talking about that Reuven over here, the Mudder, is a child, Ema Sefer, then look at the next part of the Mishnah, Ava Malamed is Bon of Mikra. We said that Shimon is allowed to teach Reuven's son's Mikra, because then there's no direct, then there's no direct Hanah, then he's just touched out on the Mishnah that he's just doing a mitzvah. So then mitzvah slav lahonis nitnu. All it is he's causing an indirect hanah, and that we've already said several times in the parak is mutter. Even in a place where people get paid for it, it's not like the father is required to pay for it. So therefore, you can't say he's giving him a hanah by foregoing it. So the Mishnah is mentioning that he can teach Reuven's children mikra, well, cotton by bonim, who, if Reuven himself was a child, how could he already have children? Doesn't that show, therefore, that we have to be talking about an adult? And if we're an adult, then we're back to the question on Rav, then why is Shimon in a position to be receiving payment for teaching anyhow, if Shimon, being an adult, doesn't need to be watched? The answer is cotton by Bonham, who was a child, somebody who himself was able to have children. The answer is chasurin mechsera. The Mishnah is missing words, according to Rav. Bahochi katani, it would mean like this. Lo yilam denu mikra. That he's not allowed to teach Reuven Mikra. That would apply b'katan. That would apply if Reuven is a katan. But imhoya gadol, if Reuven is a gadol, melamdo loy levon of Mikra, then not only is he allowed to teach Reuven, but he's also allowed to teach Reuven's children Mikra. Because then, since according to Rav, the only reason to get paid for teaching Torah is when there's schar shimur involved, then since Reuven is an adult, there's no schar shimur. Therefore, it's just like any other area of Torah where Shimon is not getting paid, and therefore there's no problem getting paid. Therefore, there's no problem that there should be any hana that he's foregoing, which then would be hana that he's giving Reuven. By the way, before we go further, the Ran points out, now the fact is that, so far we're saying that you are allowed to take schar shimur. The Ran points out another thing as well. Another thing you're allowed to be paid for when you're teaching Torah is what's called schar batola. Namely, you could have, during the time that the person is teaching, he could have been doing some other work and earning money that way. So then he's entitled to get paid for that. Lahalacha and Shulchan Aruch, it mentions Lamaisa, we do pay Melandim, and of course, even not for children, we pay teachers of adult classes as well. So the heterim for it are based on a combination of these things. When it comes to Melandim of children, you have what we're saying, Schau Shimur. The teacher is also, during the time that he's teaching them, that he has them in his classes, babysitting them. So he's entitled to be paid for that. There is Schar Batola, because he could have been doing some other work in the interim. There's also a point that some of the Mephoshim point out that if a teacher has almost the opposite of Schar Batala, in the sense that if you have a person who there's no other way that he could make a living, then he's allowed to take a salary for teaching because we want to encourage that people should become teachers. If we don't pay them, then we're not going to have any teachers at all. So for all of those reasons, for a combination of those reasons, it says in Shulchan Aruch that there is reason to pay teachers. Obviously, then based on that, then that would affect our Gemara if you're talking about a case where a teacher is in fact getting paid for medrash and halacha and so forth, then of course you would have the same din as our Mishnah. Then you'd have the same din as Mikra in our Mishnah, where he wouldn't be able to teach him it either for the same reason, because he's foregoing the hana by not taking the salary. Okay, the Gemara says Mason. I have another contradiction against Rav. A braisa says, "Tinoikus loikodin b'tchila b'Shabbos." Children are not when you're teaching them on Shabbos. Apparently, you can see over here that they had school even on Shabbos. So you're not allowed to have them read something for the first time on Shabbos. Have them learn something that they haven't learned before. Elashoyin b'rishon. All you can have them do is review what they've already previously learned. So now, at this point, the Gemara is assuming that the reason for the distinction would have to do with the teacher's salary. Well, then, according to Rabbi Yochanan, that says the reason why, to begin with, when you're teaching Mikra, that you're entitled to be paid is because of Pisuk Taimim, Hainu De'en Koren B'Tchila B'Shabbos. Well, then, we understand why it is that you can't learn something new on Shabbos, because then what is the teacher mainly getting paid for? You would assume that he's mainly getting paid for the first time that he teaches something, because that's the time it's hardest to teach. It's new to the children, so therefore it takes them a while to pick it up. So the teacher is putting in more effort. So according to Rabbi Yochanan, that you're allowed to get paid for Pisuk Taimim, then we understand if you were to teach them a new thing on Shabbos, then it comes out that you're getting paid for work on Shabbos. As opposed to, if you're reviewing something, it's not that hard to review it. So therefore, you're not really getting paid for work of Shabbos, because you don't really get paid. You don't really get paid so much for the piss of time in for teaching it to them when you're reviewing it, because they already know it. They already know it from previously. But if you say like Rab that the reason a teacher is getting paid is because he's watching the kids, well, then what's the difference? Why would you not be allowed to learn something new on Shabbos? And why would you be allowed to review something from before? Either way, aren't you getting paid for watching the kids on Shabbos? So according to Rav, why would there be that distinction? So according to Rav, you ought to say that both of them are also. If we assume that, according to Rav, that you're getting paid only because you're a glorified babysitter, because you can't teach, because you can't get paid for teaching Torah in and of itself. So what would be the difference between teaching them something the first time and getting paid for it, which would be a problem of Schar Shabbos, versus reviewing something with them and getting paid for it? Wouldn't that also be Schar Shabbos? So the Gemara answers back, nu, and according to your svara that you even asked the question, Schar Pisuch b'Shabbos mi oser, would it in fact be oser to be paid for teaching the Torah on Shabbos, which we said according to Rabbi Yochanan, you're getting paid for teaching the Torah? Would that in fact be also havla? After all, this is an example of havla. You're not getting paid individually for Shabbos. You're getting paid for Shabbos as part of a package deal that included the rest of the week. V'havla mishra shori. And to be paid via havla is perfectly mutter. Netanya, as in fact we learn in a braisa, hasoicher es apoyol lishmer es atinuk. Suppose that a person hires a worker to watch a child. Now, of course, we could be talking about plain old babysitting. However, the Ran explains, however, all of the Mefarshim over here, the Ran and the Ran and Tosfos and the Rosh all explain that we're talking. Well, the Mefarsh just says generally to watch him from becoming Tomei. The Ran and everybody else explains specifically. We're talking about that the Mishnayos and Masechta Parah describe that when they were going to be preparing a new Parah Aduma, they took extraordinary steps to make sure that everything is being done b'tahara. One of the things they would do is they would have children who were raised from birth in an area where it's impossible for them to become Tomei Mes. And then when they were old enough, they would have them ride down on the backs of oxen, and they had all kinds of precautions that they did over there also in order to draw water that then they would use to mix with the Parah Aduma ashes and sprinkle on the Kohen Gadol during the few days before he prepares a new Parah Aduma. So now you're hiring a worker to watch this child to make sure that he doesn't become Tomei, that he's going to be able to assist with the Parah Aduma. Or similarly, Lishmer Sapara, you hire a worker to watch a cow, and you mean specifically the Parah Aduma, make sure nobody puts a yoke on it or whatever. Lishmer Sazroyim, or you have somebody, or you hire somebody to watch seeds that are growing. So the Ran explains it would mean for the Omer. Means, in other words, that they would plant the grain for the Omer a couple of months. So it takes time for the grain to grow. So they would plant it a few months before the Korban Omer has to be brought. And then they would have to hire people to guard it so that other people don't walk off with it or something. A different explanation, Tosfos actually says over here, we're not talking about so much for the Omer and regular years. We're talking about rather for the Omer and the Shtei Lechem during Shemitah. During Shemitah, you have nobody is allowed to cultivate their fields, but nevertheless, that year, they still have to bring the Omer and the Shtei Lechem, and it has to be from the new crop of grain, unlike other Korbanos Mincha, where you can use old stored grain. Here, you need grain that grew this year. So there would be Sfichim, there would be places where there's grain growing on its own after growths from what's left over from seeds that fell in the ground the previous year. So Bastin would find patches of land where there exist such things, and then they would hire workers to watch those svichim so that if people want to take them, they're hefker after all, in principle, anybody could take them, then the person will tell the people that don't take it, this is being reserved for the Omer, or this is being reserved for the Shtei Lechem. Anyway, so the Braisa says, so you hire a worker to do any of those things, so you're not allowed to pay him for working on Shabbos if you're paying him on a daily basis, because then you're paying him for working on Shabbos. Lefichach, therefore, since you're not paying him for Shabbos, im avdu, if it gets lost, if, for example, the kid becomes Tomei, or somebody puts a yoke on the Parah Aduma or whatever, then he wouldn't be, if that happened on Shabbos, then he wouldn't be chayev, he wouldn't be responsible, because at that point he's a shomer chinam, and a shomer chinam is potter from gneiva v'aved. He's potter if it gets lost or stolen. He's only chayev if he was careless. On the other hand, continues the Braisa, v'im hoya schir Shabbos, on the other hand, if the person is being hired by the week, so he's being paid for an entire week as a lump sum, schir chodesh, or for a month, schir shana, or for a year, schir shavua, or you hire him for 7 straight years, in all those cases, you are allowed to pay him Schar Shabbos, because then the Shabbos is Bahavla. It's not you're paying him individually for Shabbos, but rather you're paying him in a lump sum for a certain amount of time that includes Shabbosim. Therefore, if the kid becomes tame or the parah adruma gets damaged or whatever, then he's going to be chayev because even on Shabbos, he's considered a shomer socher. So we see from that that you're allowed to be paid on Shabbos for Shabbos bahavla. So in that case, then the question would be now, so the Gemara is saying, so you were asking from this Braisa on Rab that why should there be a difference between learning the first time and the second time? But never mind that. Ask on Rabbi Yechanan. According to Rabbi Yechanan, what would be wrong with being paid for Pesach Taimim? You're not being paid on an individual basis. You could, the teacher is preposterous, being paid on a weekly or a monthly or whatever basis. And in that case, he's entitled to be paid for Shabbos as well. By the way, so there are dinim on this. This din is brought in Shulchan Aruch. So now it mentions, now suppose you don't have Bav Law. For example, let's say you hire a chazan to daven by the Yomud, Shabbos or Yom Tov. Or you hire a Baal Tekeya, you hire a Baal Kore. So what do you do as far as paying them? So in fact, in Shulchan Aruch, it brings both opinions. It says one opinion. So it brings, there is an opinion that you are allowed to because it's a matter of mitzvah. And if not for that, you're not going to have, you're not going to be able to have a chazan or a Baal Tekeya or what have you. Therefore, on the basis of the fact that it's a mitzvah, there can be a heter to do it. On the other hand, many of the Rishonim say that not, even when there's a mitzvah involved, you can't. And according to them, the only way would be able to do it by law, namely, for example, the person would have to be doing some of the work on weekdays as well. So in the case of a chazan or the case of a Baal Kore, or the case of a Baal Tekeya, for example, what you do is, so that essentially you're not being paid for the actual chazanus on Shabbos or Yom Tov, you're being paid for the practicing that you do on weekdays. And the same thing with a Baal Kore and the same thing with the rest of them. So it's not so simple to get paid for those things, but there are ways of working it out. Anyway, back to the Gemara. So again, now we're saying the Braisa seems to be a problem for both Rav and Rabbi Yechanan. According to Rav, why is there a distinction between the first time and the second time? And according to him, if you're getting paid for watching the kids, it shouldn't really matter. And if we're talking according to Rabbi Yechanan, then why would the Braisa be saying the first time you're not allowed to be paid because you're teaching them Pesach Taimim? You should be allowed to be paid for Pesach Taimim because you're being paid by Havlah. You're being paid as a package deal for teaching them on both Shabbos and weekdays. So the Gemara says, no, the reason the Braisa is making the distinction has nothing to do with the dinim of being paid on Shabbos. The reason is, Elagabe Shabbos Hainu Taima. The reason is, when it comes to teaching on Shabbos, the reason why the Braisa is saying not to learn something new the first time, the Enkoren Batchila, that you're not allowed to teach them something the first time, Mishum de Yifnu Abahos and the Anuki Lemitzvah de Shamsa. Because you want the fathers of the children to be available for the mitzvahs of Shabbos. Meaning, in other words, so the Ran explains, during the week, the fathers are working. On Shabbos, the fathers want to be able to spend time and play with their children. So if the children are learning something new, if the children are just reviewing, then the father will figure, okay, so if my kid doesn't go to Cheder on Shabbos, all they're doing is reviewing anyway, he won't mind taking him out of Cheder for the day in order to be able to play and enjoy Shabbos with him. But if they're learning something new, the father is going to be dissuaded. He's going to think to himself, you know what? If I take my kid out of class today on Shabbos, then he's going to fall behind the other students because they're going to be learning something new, and he's not. Therefore, that would be why the Braisa is saying not to teach them something new on Shabbos, in order that the fathers should have the ability to take them out of school and play with them. Or different way of understanding it. That Tosfos says is, because what's going to happen is you're going to end up delaying the Shabbos meal. The boys are going to be in cheder learning, and they're going to be learning something new, which takes longer. So therefore, you're going to end up delaying the Shabbos meal, and therefore you're missing out on owning Shabbos. So that's one reason. The Iboy Seima, another reason would be, because on Shabbos you eat and drink extra, the Yakur Aloyan Alma, the world feels very heavy to them. In other words, a person feels very, very heavy and bloated after eating a lot. And therefore, in other words, the kids don't really have the head to learn something new. the Kedama Shmuel, as we find what Shmuel says, we learned at the end of Ksubas, Shinui Vest Chilas Cholam Ayim, the changing your normal habits, in this case, eating more foods and richer foods on Shabbos than you do during the week, is the beginning of stomach aches. So in other words, these kids, they're eating extra on Shabbos, therefore they're feeling very heavy, and therefore they don't have the head for learning something new on Shabbos. So therefore, according to that, the Brai says, so according to either of these things, the Brai says is not saying that there's an Isur to teach them something new on Shabbos. It's saying for practical reasons, you shouldn't. Either because, again, it's interfering with earning Shabbos, or because the kids themselves are not really going to be able to pick up something new anyway because they're too full. So either way, the Braisa is not a contradiction to either Rav or Rabbi Yochanan, because it's not saying that you can't be paid for teaching on Shabbos. It's saying between Shabbos and weekdays is not because of payment versus non-payment. It has to do with other factors. Okay, fine. So we don't have a proof against either Rav or Rabbi Yochanan, but the Gemara asks, why does each one need a reason of his own? According to Rabbi Yochanan, that the payment that you're allowed to take for teaching Mikra is the fact that you're teaching Torah. Why doesn't he agree with Rab? The fact is, you're teaching little kids. You have to watch them so they don't run out into the street, like the Rosh said. So why, according to Rabbi Yochanan, is that not enough of a factor? Why does he need to mention Pesach timing? The answer is Kasava, because Rabbi Yochanan takes the view, bonus mika boy and shimmer. After all, the Mishnah had said that the Mishnah had talked about that you're there wouldn't be an issue with girls, because girls are not prone to running out into the street. At least that's how it was in those times. Now, the Mishnah had said generically that you can't teach Mikra without distinguishing between boys and girls. If you were going to say that it is a matter of Shimur, then the Mishnah should have told us that you're not allowed to teach boys, but you're allowed to teach girls. The other way, but you're allowed to teach girls, because with girls there's no schar shimur. The Rosh explains rather that what we're talking about is that the Mishnah had said that you're allowed to teach the sons and daughters of the Mudr Hana. So now, the reason is because you're doing a mitzvah. But according to Rabbi Yochanan is saying, if we followed Rav's opinion, then we would be saying that there should be a difference between boys and girls. You would be saying that never mind. We'd be saying, why is it you're allowed to teach girls? Nothing to do with that. Nothing to do with whether it's a mitzvah or not. The fact is, with girls, you don't need schar shimur, and therefore there's nothing to be paid for.
How about hot water?
What about it?
And the kid can get burned by that, so you gotta be careful.
Right. Apparently, the Gemara is assuming that when we say schar shimur, we're talking strictly making sure, like the Rosh said, that they don't run out into the street and cause damage. Since girls in those times generally didn't do that, then therefore you wouldn't have that problem. Apparently, the Gemara is not talking about the kind of thing, I mean, like this, you know, a teacher has to keep order in class and so forth. Apparently, the Gemara is not calling that in the category of schar shimur. Maybe kids back then were more well-behaved, or it's a valid point. You learn this Gemara, it kind of jumps out at you. But yeah, the Gemara seems to be limiting schar shimur to just the kind of thing where the kids will run out into the street, where with boys that will be an issue, and with girls it won't. So Rabbi Yochanan can't accept Rav's explanation, because then there would have to be a difference between boys and girls. And again, according to the Ran, the point is the Mishnah didn't make any such distinction. It didn't say that you're allowed to teach girls, but you're not allowed to teach boys. And according to the Rosh, rather, it was, because the Mishnah mentioned that in the case of the children, you're allowed to teach the mudders. Boys or girls, where the reason seems to be the same thing, because you're only intending to do a mitzvah. Whereas according to Rab's reason, there would be another difference, because by boys there's schar shimur, and by girls there's not. Okay, now what about the other way around? Ulamanda omas schar shimur. according to Rav, who says that the teacher is being paid for watching the children, my time, almost schar pisuk time, why doesn't he say that you're entitled to be paid for teaching them the Torah? And the answer is kasava, schar pisuk time, because in fact, Rav disagrees with Rabbi Yechanan's premise. Unlike Rabbi Yechanan, who said that the pisuk time is not daraisa, where again, we said that could mean that literally they're not daraisa and they were introduced by the Chachamim, by the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, or it could mean that they are daraisa, but according to Rabbi Yechanan, they're not an essential part of teaching Torah. Rav disagrees with that. And Rav says, in fact, it is fully daraisa. Well, then it would be the same thing as we learned on Amar Aleph, the same way as we said that Moshe said to the people, ma ani b'chinam af atem b'chinam. So Rav would say the same thing would apply equally well to the Torah. So therefore, the only reason to be matur, a teacher, to take schar would be schar shimu, would be because he's watching the kids. Where do we see that Rav says that? The Amar of Ikaba of in Amar of Hanano Amar Rav. My dichtiv, what does it mean? A pasuk in the Nehemiah portion of Ezra. Originally, Ezra and Nehemiah were one long sefer of about 700 psukim. The Goyim divided it the same way as they divided most of the chapters in Tanakh. They divided it into two. I mean, there is a logic behind it because the portion that begins Nehemiah begins Divrei Nehemiah ben Chachalia. From there on, it's Nehemiah speaking in first person and describing his experiences, but still, whatever. Anyway, so in that section, why did they divide it? The straightforward reason they divided it is because just that, because each one seems to be its own part. I've mentioned before an interesting vote from the Chidah. He says the deeper reason, so why did that become accepted by us Jews as well? He says the Gemara tells us in Sanhedrin that the reason why Nehemiah didn't have the Sefer named after him, even though Nehemiah's portion of that Sefer is actually larger than Ezra's, is the Gemara gives a few reasons over there of things that Nehemiah did that relative to a tzaddik like him, he shouldn't have done. He asked Hashem to give him credit for his mitzvahs, and he spoke badly about the previous governors of Eretz Yisrael, which included Daniel, who was greater than him. Anyway, the Gemara says, for those reasons, he forfeited the chance to have the Sefer named after him. So now the Chidah brings from earlier Sfarim that Nehemiah and Ezra were later on misgalgal in Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. And you have the whole story in Brachos of how Rabbi Gamliel was deposed from the Nasius, and Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah was appointed as Nasi instead, and eventually they reinstated Rabbi Gamliel, whatever. So the Chidah says Rabbi Gamliel went through tremendous humiliation in that story, being deposed as Nasi. So therefore, min hashamayim, it was decided that eventually that takes care, that because his neshama was the neshama of Nehemiah, therefore it was decided min hashamayim that eventually that takes care of the things that the Gemara and Sanhedrin said that he did wrong, and therefore he deserves to have it safer named after him after all.
Curious, though, why Goyim had to divide, what was that?
Why they divided? Because the same way they divided. The Goyim, think of it, the Christians believe in our Bible as well, so they were the ones who divided up they were the ones who did most of the chapter divisions, yeah. We're talking about in the 1300s, some bishop in England, yeah. And eventually, after the Gemara's times, In the Gemara's times, it was still generally where the Sefer Ezra was one long Sefer that consisting of about 700 psukim that described the stories of Ezra and Nehemiah and the Jewish people at the beginning of the second Mishmash. Anyway, there's a pasuk over there. It describes how everybody is gathered near the Bes Mikdash to hear Ezra read from the Torah. And the pasuk says, "Vayikru b'sefer Torah Salakim." They read from the Sefer of the Torah of Hashem, Mefodosh, clearly explained, v'soim sechel, and giving the understanding, v'yavinu b'mikra, and they giving the sense of the pasuk, v'yavinu b'mikra, and they understood the psukim. So what does that mean? What do each of those phrases in the pasuk mean? Says Rabbi Ikaba Ovin in the name of Rabbi Hananel in the name of Rav. Vayikru b'sefer Torah Salakim Zemikra. The words, the first four words of the pasuk they read in the sefer of the Torah of Hashem. That means the mikra. That means the actual words of the psukim. When it says they explained it clearly, that means they also said the Targum, the Aramaic translation, pasuk by pasuk, so everybody would understand. Because we're talking at the beginning of the second Bais Mikdash, they had just been 70 years in Golas Bavel, not everybody understood Lashon Kodesh anymore. People, their common spoken language was Aramaic, so they had to give them the Targum. Then the pasuk continues, v'soim sechel, they gave the sense, elu apsukim, that means the divisions between one pasuk and the next, which helps you make sense of what the Torah is saying. And Vayavinu Bamikra, when it says they understood in the Psukim, Ze Pisuk Taimim, that refers to the divisions as far as the Terah, because the Terah, besides that they're musical, they also function as punctuation. The Esnachta is like a semicolon, the Tipcha and the Zakif Gadol and then Zakif Katan and so forth are like commas and so on and so forth. So they help to break up the Pasuk into syntactic units to be able to make sense of the Pasuk. So that's Vayavinu Bamikra. The Amri Law. So the point is, Rav is saying the Pisuk Taimim is all of the things we're listing in this pasuk. We have to assume are halacha l'moshe Sinai. So now the pasuk is informing us that when Ezra read the Torah to the people, then he was including all of those details. But Amri Law. But others say again, this Amri Law would be following Rabbi Yechanan's opinion, Elo HaMasodas, that rather it refers to the Masoda of which words are written without a vav or a yod, or with them. You have many words in Torah where they can be spelt in two possible ways. One without a vav, and you have and the word has a cholam, but there's no vav written for the cholam, and other places where it's written with. So according to that, Vayavinu Bamikra would refer to those details. So that would follow Rabbi Yechanan's opinion, who says that the Pisuk Taimim is not Daraisa, but was added later by the Chacham. Okay. So we see, in other words, that Rab holds that Pisuk Taimim is Daraisa. Therefore, according to him, you can't get paid for teaching that any more than you could for teaching any other part of Torah. So according to him, the only reason that a teacher would get paid is Schar Shimur, because he's watching the kids. Okay. So now in this connection, the Gemara is going to bring some interesting things about the Masorah. Amr Rabbi Yitzchak, Mikra Sofrim. Rabbi Yitzchak tells us the Mikra Sofrim, the correct way of pronouncing the words. Sofrim means the Chachamim. The Gemara elsewhere explains that the early Chachamim were called Sofrim, chose Sofrim kol osias shebat Torah. They counted up all the letters in the Torah and made sure that it's transmitted exactly from generation to generation. So now we're saying Mikra Sofrim means the fact that you have the fact that words are pronounced a certain way in the Torah. So that's all part of Torah Shavah Peh. It was transmitted to us through the Sofrim. So you shouldn't think, in other words, we're calling them Sofrim. Don't think it means that the Sofrim, that the Chachamim invented these things. It means that they're, as he's going to go on to say, they're all Halacha L'Moshe Mishinai. They transmitted to us the Halacha L'Moshe Mishinai for each word, how it's supposed to be pronounced, as the Gemara is going to give examples soon. The Itur Sofrim, also the decorations of the Sofrim, meaning where the Sofrim, where the Chachamim explained to us that certain words in the Pasuk are not needed for the simple sense of the Pasuk. They're just there for stylistic reasons, to make the style of the writing, to make the style of the writing of the Pasuk go more nicely. The Kalyan Velek Sivan, and the cases where we have words that are read, but they're not actually written in the Torah. Now, we don't mean Kriyuk Siv, that's something else. That's where you have a word is written one way and pronounced a different way. Here we're talking about, the Gemara is going to give examples, you have words here and there in Tanakh where the word is not actually written in the text of Tanakh, but we say it Baal Peh, where the Gemara is going to give us examples soon. Itur Sofrim literally means the decorations of the Sofrim. So it means, the Gemara is going to explain in a couple of lines, that it means there are certain words, sometimes we have words in the Torah where the Torah could have phrased it differently. It didn't have to use that word, but it used it for stylistic reasons. It doesn't mean the tagim. No, that's something else. The Kalyan Velek Sivan, things where a word is read in the Pasuk by Baal Peh, but not actually written. Uksivan Velek Kalyan, and sometimes you have in Tanakh the other way around. You have a word that's written in the text, but it's not meant to be read. All of those things, halacha l'moshe Mishinai, all of those things are halacha l'moshe Mishinai. I don't think that the Sofrim invented them. And in fact, the Radvaz adds, now the examples the Gemara is going to be giving of Ksivan v'lo Kalyan and Kalyan v'lo Ksivan, all of those and a couple, and at least one of the examples of Itur Sofrim are all going to be examples from Nach. Now, Nach is long after the time of Moshe on Har Sinai. So the Radvaz explains, though, that since we know, Chazal tell us that Moshe, that everything that's in Torah in future generations as well, was given to Moshe Rabbeinu. So these things were actually given to Moshe, and Moshe was told that they're not meant to be written down, given to the Jewish people right now. They're meant to be known by the Chachamim, and eventually they will be written down. So you have the psukim of Nach. In other words, were taught to Moshe as well, along with these variations that we're talking about. So what are examples of each of these things? Mikra Sofrim, for example, Eretz Shamayim Mitzrayim. For example, consider the word Eretz. Most of the time it's pronounced Eretz with two segals, but sometimes we have at the end of a pasuk or in a snachta or something, instead we say Oretz. that kind of thing. You wouldn't know it from the written letters of Tanakh. And again, the Nekudas were written down only long afterwards, only in the times of the Goyim. So therefore, that's part of Mikra Sofrim, that the Chachamim taught us what's Halach Lamosh Misinai, where you say Eretz versus where you say Oretz. Similarly, Shamayim Mitzrayim. So here you have a couple of explanations what that means. The Ran explains that it means that even though these words, Shamayim and Mitzrayim, don't have an Aleph in them, you read them as though they had an Aleph. In other words, you would have thought maybe you say Shamim or Mitzrim or something instead. You have as if there's an Aleph in them, Shamayim, Mitzrayim. So that kind of thing, you wouldn't know without Torah Shabbat Peh, without the Sofrim, without the Chachamim teaching us that. Eretz and Oretz, right. With Shamayim and Mitzrayim also, another explanation is that it means the same kind of thing that you have So the Mefarish explains that it means the same thing. The fact that we say, for example, Shamayim, how do we know that there is a comet on the shin? After all, there's no Aleph written over there to represent the comets. That is also part of this Mikra Sofim. So those kinds of things. A different point that somebody makes is that each of these words you actually find someplace else in Tanakh where the same letters are used with completely different nekudas. For example, the word Eretz, you have most of the time the letters Aleph, Resh, Tzadik mean Eretz, mean land. But you have, for example, a Pasuk in Tehillim with the same letters where you have the word Orutz, I will run. So therefore, you need Mikra Sofrim to tell us where it's one and where it's the other. Iter Sofrim, what do we mean by decorations of the Sofrim? So we mean, for example, Achar Ta'avodu. For example, in Parshas Vayera, when Avraham tells the guests, let me give you a little bread and you'll satisfy yourselves. Achar ta'avodu. Afterwards, you will go on. Now, it didn't have to say achar. It could have said vita'avodu. It could have said, I'll give you some bread, visa'avodu, and you will leave. Instead, it says achar ta'avodu, which is like a stylistic thing to make the pasuk sound nicer. Similarly, achar tevach. Similarly, you have at the end of Chayesara when Lavan and his mother are suggesting that Rachel should stay a little longer, they say, let her stay here for 10 months, for a year or 10 months, achar teilech, then she will go. Again, they could have said vis teilech, but again, the achar is more a stylistic thing to make the pasuk sound nicer. Similarly, achar teosif, by Miriam at the end of Parashas Ba'al Oscha, where Hashem tells him that she'll have tzaras for a week and then she'll be gathered in, then she'll be reunited with the people. Same thing, the achar is extra. And an example from Tilim, Kidmu Sharim Achar Noigdim. The pasuk says the singers went ahead after the people playing instruments, talking about by Kriyas Yamsuf. So again, it didn't have to say the word achar. It could have said kidmu shodim v'noignim or something to that effect. And the achar is there for stylistic reasons. So that's the Ran explains. That's what it means by all the. So that's one explanation. The Ran says that it means that all of these, in all four of these places, the word achar is extra. Then the Ran says another point is that in each of these psukim, it's the truck really. It's not so much the words, it's the truck that tell you how to punctuate the pasuk correctly. For example, in Achar Ta'avodu, if you didn't have the truck placed properly, then you would think, it means Vesadu Libchem Achar Ta'avodu, you would think that the word Achar means after. So it would mean you'll satisfy yourselves after you pass by. In other words, that Avram is suggesting them to take along some food with them to eat on the road. Instead, because of the way the trup are placed, says the Ran in a second explanation, the trup help us understand that no, he means that achar means afterwards, not after. So you should eat something, afterwards you will leave. And the same thing with the other ones where because the way the trup are placed helps us understand that the word achar in each of those doesn't mean it doesn't mean after, but rather afterwards. Then the Rosh brings a different point. He says, the word itur, all this time we've been translating the word itur as meaning decorations, like we're saying words that are just there for decorative purposes. He points out another meaning, and the Oruch says the same, says something similar. The word itur is also related to a word in Aramaic that means to remove. So on the contrary, it means things where the Chachamim explain to us that there's something removed, something that's missing from the pasuk where you would expect it to be. Namely, in each of these cases, you would expect there to be a vav. V'sadu libchem v'achar ta'avodu, satisfy yourselves with some food, and afterwards you will leave. Instead, the pasuk says achar ta'avodu, so the Sofrim explained to us that this is how Hashem transmitted the pasuk to Moshe, and therefore don't think to add a vav on your own there in order to make the pasuk clearer. No, realize that this is how Hashem transmitted it to Moshe with that vav missing for reasons that we don't understand. So that's the, so those are examples of Itur Sofrim. And another example is Tzidkos Kokahare Kehu. Your Tzedakah, we say to Hashem, is like the mighty mountains. So again, the Ran says one possibility is that it means that it didn't have to say the Chof. It could have said, it could have said Tzidkos Kokahare Kehu. It could have said Your Tzedakah is the mighty mountains, the same way as the next part of the pasuk continues, Mishpotecha Tahoim Rabba. Your judgments are the great deep. So therefore, but the chaf is there for stylistic reasons to make it sound nicer. And then the second explanation that Ran says is similarly, that means that's true. Help us realize that the word kale is not actually modifying the word hadarei, like this, we translate hadarei kale as the mountains of Hashem, meaning mighty mountains. Instead, the truck tell us to understand the word kale as though it goes to the beginning of the pasuk. That we're saying Hashem, the word kale is evocative. We are speaking to Hashem. Your tzedakah is like the mountains. So therefore, again, so the Itur Sofrim tells us, according to the second explanation, the Tura tell us to put the word in its proper place. What are some examples, the Gemara says, of Kavyan V'leksivan, of words where you read something Baalpeh in Tanakh, but you don't have the word written down? For example, Pros de Belechtoi. For example, you have a pasuk in Shmuel describing when David is going with his army to fight against one of the kings of Aram. The pasuk says that this king, Hadadezer, his name was, had gone to put his monument up by Nahar Pros, and David went and defeated him over there. So the word Pros is not written in the pasuk, but we read it. When we read the pasuk, when a person is reading that pasuk, he has to supply the word Pros on his own. In our Tanakhs nowadays, of course, we have it written in the margin or in parenthesis or whatever, but in the original, in other words, if you had in the times of the Gemara, if you had a handwritten copy of Sefer Shmuel and you read that pasuk, you would have, the pasuk would say, Belechta lahatziv yodim inahar, and the next word would be missing, and you would have to supply it baalpeh.
It's not
kriyuksiv. What?
Is that kriyuksiv?
So it's more than kriyuksiv. Kriyuksiv is when you have the word is written, but it's written in a different form. You have, for example, you have places where the Torah uses instead of a more coarse word, instead of a less delicate word, the Torah uses a more delicate one. Or you have, for example, let's say you have a word loy with an aleph, and we read it as loy with a vav, or different things like that. Here it's more than that. Here the word as a whole is not even written, and you have to supply it completely baalpeh. So you're looking at Sefer Shmuel, for example. You're looking at printed Tanakh. You'll find in this pasuk, so again, different Tanakhs will mark it in different ways. Some of them will have like a space with only the Nekudas, and then in the margin there'll be a note what the word is supposed to be. Some of them will have you have to read it as if it was written. Different Tanakhs will do it differently, but the point is it's not part. The Masoda is over there that you have the word is missing in writing, and you supply it baalpeh. So that's one example. Another example, Ish the Kasha Yishal Ish Bidvar HaLakim, another one from Sefer Shmuel, where it describes Achitofel, David's trusted advisor, who ended up betraying David and going over to Avshalom. So the pasuk says to ask Achitofel's advice was as reliable as if a person is asking the word of Hashem. His advice was always something that you could rely on. So the word Ish over there again is missing if you again in a handwritten Tanakh, or in printed ones for that matter, you'll find that the word ish over there is missing and you have to supply it baalpeh. So again, in present day, printed Tanakhs, it'll be in parenthesis or it'll be in the margin or whatever. Another example, Boim de Nivnasa, another example, a pasuk from Yirmiya, where Hashem says, Hine yamim boim, behold, days are coming and your Yerushalayim will be rebuilt. And the word boim is missing. Another example, Lot de Plata, another example also from Yirmiya. He has a nevuah against Bavel. He says that to destroy Bavel, there won't be any remnant left of it, and the word Lot is missing. And the word S, the Hugad Hugadli, and another one is the word S in a pasuk in Rus, where Boaz says to Rus, I've been told everything that you did for Naomi, your mother-in-law. So the word S is another one of these Kayan Velek Sivan. Here actually, the Ran points out that our Sforim, our Tanakhs, do not have that distinction. They have the word S is in there, and there's no Kriyuk Siv at all. In fact, it comes out, apparently the Masoda that the Gemara had, it seems that in some places the Masoda the Gemara had was slightly different than the Masoda we have nowadays. There's a Rabbi Akiva Eger on Shabbos, for example, that brings a couple of dozen examples of that from all over Shas, where the Gemara says that a certain word is spelt a certain way and our Masoda tells us differently. That's how it is. There were slightly different Masodas between Bnei Bavel and Bnei Eretz Yisrael. And of course, the Gemara was written in Bavel, whereas for the most part in our Masoda of Tanakh, we usually follow Bnei Eretz Yisrael. So you have slight variations. Anyway, so Minchas Shai actually mentions over there that this seems to be one of those variations. Another example, Eli Dagoden, another of the next two examples, Eli Dagoden, Eli Dasaodim, the next two examples are both from Rus as well. In Peret Gimel of Rus, where Naomi tells Rus to go down to the granary and stay there overnight and talk with Boaz. So Rus tells her, everything that you tell me, Kol Hashatomri Eli Esa, the word Eli is missing and you have to supply it about there. And then later on in that same Peret, when she comes back and Boaz has given her barley, and she tells Naomi that he says Ki Omar Eli, he told to me, don't go home empty-handed to your mother-in-law. So again, the word Eli is missing, and you have to supply it balpeh. So each of these things, and the Hagoris Hagra, the Vilna Gaon, adds a couple of more that we have in Or Masoda, which you find also in Masechta Sofrim. There's a few other places in Nach where you have such things, where you have a word that's missing, and we have to supply it balpeh. So all of those are examples of this kind of thing. We're calling them a Kaoyan Vloik Sivan. They're not written in the Pasuk. We have to supply them Malpeh. They're all Halacha L'Moshe Misinai. Reasons for them, I mean, in each of those Pesukim, you have some of them you have explanations that the Mephoshim on the Pesukim give. For example, the one about Kasha Yishal Ish B'Dvar HaLakim. There's a Medrash that says, because Achitofel was on such a high level, his advice was always so reliable, it's like he wasn't a person, it's like he was a malach. So therefore it leaves out the word ish, and we supply it only baal peh. And the same thing with each of the other ones, there are explanations that are given for a deeper reason why it is. So Ahola and Kari and Velikosvan, all of these are examples of things that are written but not read. The Kosvan or Lekari, and then you have the other way around, we're saying there are things that are written in the Pasuk, but you don't actually read them. For example, Nod Yislach, at the end of the story of Naaman, the Arami general who was cured of Tzaraas, he says that I'm not going to worship Avodah Zarah anymore. However, when I have to go with my master, the king, to base Rima into the temple of the Avodah Zarah, I'm going to have to bow with him. Hashem should please forgive me for that. So the word no is written over there, but we don't read it. Zois da mitzvah, you have the word zois in connection with mitzvah. And here, so the Ram says that would be a pasuk in Vashanan. However, again, we don't have it in our Sfarim. We don't have it in our Tanakhs like that. Hagoris Hagura changes it actually. He says the Gira says supposed to be es da nefesh, and it's referring to a pasuk in Yirmiyah. Another one, Yidrech da hadorech, another one from Yirmiyah, part of his Nevuah against Babel. He says the archers will shoot their bows against Babel. So you have a word Yidroich over there that's written twice, and only one of them is read. Chamesh to pass Negev. You have at the end of the Chezkel, he describes Yerushalayim of Asid Lavoi. He describes the dimensions of it. And there's one place over there where it says the word Chamesh twice in a row, and we read only one of them. Im deki goyel, and you have in Rus, when Boaz says to Rus that actually there is somebody who is closer than me, a closer relative to your late husband than I am. So we have to ask him first whether he wants to be goyo you. So there's an im over there. Holin, Kasvan, like Kalyan, these are examples of things that are written in the Pasuk, but not read. So again, in present day Tanakhs, you'll find they do different things with them. Many times what they'll do is they'll print them without Mekudis to show that it's not meant to be read. Anyway, and again, Agoris Agura adds, based on Masechta Sofrim, a couple more examples that the Gemara didn't list over here of other things like that, where you have words that are written in the Pasuk and not read. And again, there are drushes for each one of them. So these are all things. Rabbi Yitzchak is telling us you should be aware that all of these things are Halacha L'Moshe Misinai, and don't think that they were just added, that they were just invented by the Sofrim or something like that. Okay, and we'll continue tomorrow more on that topic and get into we talked about that Hashem gave the Torah to Moshe and he taught it to us Jewish people. So now we're going to get into some Agadah about that tomorrow, Bez Hashem.